So I'm very pleased that Joanne Cochera-Morin, Curtis Rose, and the associates are giving this rather special colloquium today. Joanne Cochera-Morin is the founder and the creator and the present director of CREATE. And Curtis Rose is the associate director of CREATE, which stands for the Center for Research in Electronic Art and Technology. The center was established in 1986 and is situated within the Departments of Music and the Media Arts Technology Department at UCSB. So the center serves as a laboratory for research and development of a new generation of software and hardware tools to aid in media-based composition. I might also add that Curtis Rhodes has been a composer and researcher in the fields of computer music for over 30 years. And his textbook on computer music is the standard in his field. So if you want to get into computer music, he is the guy that you should talk to. I also like to mention that Luca Paliti, who is known to us as a distinguished theoretical physicist, that many of us know over the years, who worked in many areas of theoretical physics, and who is in residence this quarter here at the KITP, got involved with CREATE, with the center, when he came here 2 years ago. And so as far as I know, this is the first instance of a KITP visitor actively collaborating with people in the music department. So it's a very interesting collaboration between musicians and physicists, and we'll see what comes out. So Luca has been working very hard on this project, trying to visualize and sonify the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Let me remind the audience that you're all invited to participate in the to experience the Allosphere right across the street in the Nano building after the talk. Okay, let's get started.
Okay, so I'm Curtis Rhodes, and I'm going to give a very brief overview of projects pursued over the past 5 years in our laboratories. This research is based on a scientific model of sound, initially proposed by the physicist Denis Gabor in the late 1940s. In Gabor's conception, all sound can be considered as a combination of what he called acoustic quanta, or what we today would call grains. Specific to the granular model of sound is its focus on the microsonic scale between 1 millisecond and 100 milliseconds. As Gabor pointed out, this time scale is of special pertinence to auditory perception, as it corresponds to the range of auditory difference thresholds, that is, the smallest time scale in which psychoacoustic phenomena such as pitch, timbre, loudness, spatial position, and temporal order are still salient. Granular methods consider sound as a combination of acoustic particles in both the time domain and the time frequency domain. The polymath, composer, engineer, and architect Yannis Xenakis studied Gabor's papers and proposed the idea of granular synthesis of sound. Inspired by Xenakis' idea, I programmed a computer to realize granular synthesis for the first time. Today, granular models have evolved into a broad range of applied techniques, and my interest in the granular models is twofold. First, music can be seen as a pattern of time frequency energy sketched on the canvas of time. Granular methods provide a flexible spray jet for the distribution of this energy in terms of sound particles. Using such tools extends the realm of composition down to the internal structure of individual sounds. And second, as Gabor observed, all sound can be viewed as a combination of elementary functions bounded in frequency and time. Through new analysis methods that generate granular representations, we can visualize sounds in new ways that elucidate and articulate its internal structure and also transform it in novel ways. There's not enough time today to present all the directions of this research, but I will only touch on a few aspects. I'll demonstrate some of the visualizations we've developed in conjunction with this, some of which are motivated by scientific aims, some of which are motivated by artistic aims, some of which attempt to satisfy both. Finally, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Bob Sturm, a doctoral candidate in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, who will give an overview of our dictionary-based granular approach to time frequency analysis. Very brief history of the granular model. The idea that a continuous tone could be decomposed into small quantities of energy emerged from ancient Greek atomistic philosophers. Later, at the dawn of early modern science, the French thinkers Gassendi and Descartes revived atomism. Issues in acoustics were central to the birth of science in Western Europe, and a confluence of intellectual energy emanating from Descartes, Galileo, Bacon, Mersenne, Gassendi, Boyle, and others gradually forced a paradigm shift away from the Aristotelian philosophical point of view toward a more experimental perspective. The modern concept of sound particles or sound quanta can be traced to Einstein's phonons, which he predicted in 1907. But the phonons consist of inaudible packets of ultrasonic energy at feeble amplitudes. It was Einstein's pupil, Denis Gabor, who in the 1940s had the fundamental insight that brought the particle model into the domain of perceived sound. And of course, Gabor won the Nobel Prize not for this theory, but for his invention of holography. Gabor's pioneering theory of sound was overlooked in the development of the widely adopted method called the short-time Fourier transform, or the STFT, at Bell Telephone Laboratories in the 1960s. Gabor's work was later rediscovered and revived in the rise of the theory of wavelets. In particular, in 1993, Malat and Zhang published a pioneering paper in the IEEE Transactions on Signal Processing that proposed a new approach to time frequency analysis that has been given many names, from atomic decomposition to sparse approximation to dictionary-based methods. And these methods can all be seen as the analytical counterpart to granular synthesis. Recently, Professor John Schenck in the Department of ECE here and I received a grant from the National Science Foundation to improve these methods of analysis. And as I mentioned, our student, Bob Sturm, will present this research in a moment. We believe that dictionary methods are particularly effective for the study of complex signals, such as specific types of noises. A typical example of a complex noise signal is the engine sound of a Ferrari sports car. We were recently asked by the Ferrari Concept Group in Maranello, Italy, to analyze the sound of their sports cars. This is the result of one of these analyses. Using our analysis method, for example, it was possible to cleanly separate the gearbox rattle from the engine hum on the basis of the time scale of the granular energy. And I'd like to just play that engine sound. So this is a type of sound that Ferrari was having difficulty analyzing with the traditional Fourier harmonic-based methods, but which it seems better suited to this method, which is particularly good at analyzing noises. Finally, I'm going to show some visualizations based on our research. One thrust of research in our laboratories falls under the rubric of visualization and sonification. Here is a project that visualizes sound data, in this case, my composition, sonal atoms. The visualization was produced by projecting the time frequency energy of the piece into color and form. The two sides of the image correspond to the two channels of sound. The vertical position of the circles represents the frequency content, or the frequency axis, while the size of the circles corresponds to their amplitude. A sinusoidal displacement of the frequency axes occurs when the total energy is high. Yeah, we're going to play the DVD. Hello? That's spinning up. Okay. So this was a particular realization was done by our student Woon Sung Yeo. He's a typical example of an MAT product. He came to our program with an undergraduate degree, actually had a master's degree in electrical engineering. Got a second master's degree in media arts and technology, and is now finishing a music PhD at Stanford, a real hybrid. So I think I got some idea. The same piece has also been visualized by an artist, not following a direct mapping between the time and frequency energy, but in a much, but in a very creative manner also. I'm not going to play that. I'd now like to introduce Bob Sturm, who received his bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Colorado, but who also has master's degrees in music science and technology from Stanford, Media Arts and Technology from UCSB, and ECE here at UCSB. He'll be completing his PhD in ECE next month and will assume a postdoc at my alma mater, the University of Paris, in the spring. So please welcome Bob Sturm. Right, the microphone.
Everyone hear me? Can those people on the internet hear me? All right. So I've been working with Curtis and with Dr. Schenck for a few years now in this realm of sparse approximation, atomic decomposition, overcomplete methods. There's many names for it, and it actually goes back a very long time to one of Tukey's ideas at Bell Labs. I'm going to give you a brief overview of it, so with some pretty pictures, not a lot of math, so that you get a general idea of what's going on. So consider these two signals. One is a very short length signal of 90 milliseconds, and one is a very long signal of 3.5 seconds. This is both musical signals. The top is from a composition by Curtis, and this is a Glockenspiel struck hammered metal bars, musical bars. We would like to work with the content in these signals. There are tonal portions that have harmonics in them, well-organized, pseudo-stationary. There are attack portions that describe the onset of the energy in the instrument. And there's possibly reverberation. There could be noise that's from something extraneous to the instrument, such as air conditioning. And in the above image, we would also like to work with some aspects of the signal, whether rearranging particular components of it or processing in some sorts. Now, how are we able to do such a thing? Well, we can use the Fourier transform. We can just take the Fourier transform of the entire signal, and now we go to a new domain that tells us the energy at particular frequencies. But this has limited usefulness because now we've lost all sorts of time resolution over this 3.5 seconds. We know very well what the frequencies are and possibly their energies, but we don't know when they occurred over the entire signal. And the same thing occurs up here. Because it's so short, we have very little frequency resolution. We can use the short time Fourier transform. As Curtis mentioned, this is a technique that was developed straight out of Gabor's methods, where we now partition the time domain into slices and perform a... Oh, the Fourier transform is basically... Oh, the short term. Okay, so considering this 90 millisecond signal, we break a longer signal into 90 millisecond segments and perform a Fourier transform at each one of those segments. And then we take and plot the log magnitudes of these transforms, and we get a picture of the concentration of energy as a function of frequency in each one of those slices. So at each 90 millisecond slice, we know where the energy is occurring over that. So we have windowed the signal into little pieces, perform the Fourier transform of that, and come up with this very redundant representation. There's many more samples in the time frequency domain here than there are in the time domain. So we've increased our data, our representation of the signal, but we have possibly a new way to pick particular components at particular frequencies and times to modify. But then we pay a price for time frequency trade-off. Heisenberg uncertainty principle comes in here, where we can choose either very good frequency resolution and poor time resolution, or very good time resolution, but poor frequency resolution. Wavelet transform has become a popular technique to deal with signals that have a lot of discontinuities in them. And you can see Pictor Alpha has now scale in time, where scale describes how we've squashed, how we've scaled the wavelet function that we've used to analyze it. In Glockenspiel, the analysis is kind of useless. We don't really know at a particular scale what that represents. What does that mean? So the additional, an alternative method, we can adapt a representation. We can take a bunch of functions that we want to describe our signal in terms of, give it to the algorithm, this dictionary-based method, and it's going to pick the functions from the dictionary that, in a sense, best explain portions of the signal. And so here we see good time resolution, but also very good frequency resolution. We have this multi-resolution and very sparse time frequency representation of the signal in both domains. So now, as you saw before, you have very poor time resolution, good frequency resolution. Here we have very sharp, short-scale atoms, short-scale pieces at the times of the attacks, but we also have very long-scale atoms around the times of the tonals. So these functions, so the whole aspect of dictionary-based methods is what goes into the dictionary. So one of the things, you can use wavelets, different scales. You can use atoms that are used in audio coding. You can use different scales of Gabor atoms at many different lengths and modulation frequencies. You can learn the atoms in some sense. I've got a bunch of speech, and then I have a mixture of speech and environmental noise. I can learn from the speech signals those atoms that best describe speech so that I can extract them from the noise. So how is this representation adapted? We take our signal into this big black box, and out comes a book. This book describes the atoms at particular times, the energies of these atoms, and other characteristics, other parameters that describe them. But within this black box, we have this dictionary. The algorithm looks at each step at the signal, compares it to the dictionary of atoms, and finds the one atom that best describes the signal, subtracts it, and performs it again and again and again. And this is called match pursuit, because it pursues a representation by matching. But it is highly nonlinear, which is very interesting. You perturb this input signal just by a little bit, the results could be drastically different, and you'll see an example of that in a second. So here's a very simple example. We have three periods of a sinusoid plus the time of a transient. Yes? Yes. You would continue the decomposition until you've reached a point that you're satisfied and you can't really pull anything else. The first step. Okay. What is this? Right. You have to define similarity. And the way Malott and Zong did it in this algorithm is to find the atom that has the largest magnitude projection onto the signal. Basic correlation. Or you could do a weighted correlation. Or there's another method that takes it into the frequency domain so that you perform the correlation there. The sensitivity, right, and these are all aspects of this nonlinear algorithm, how you define it. And that is a big ask. That's chapter 3 and 4 out of my PhD thesis, which will be done very soon. So here's a very simple example. We're going to decompose this signal up here, which has a sinusoid and a transient, this attack, over this dictionary of Gabor atoms, plus Dirac basis, plus a bunch of spikes. And we see the first atom it finds, the most correlated atom, is this one. The second one picks up this hump. Third one picks up this hump, fourth one. And then the fifth atom finds the transient, the attack. So now we have, in a sense, cheated the time-frequency trade-off by combining this dictionary, these dictionaries together and decomposing the signal in this way. And here is the time-frequency distribution of energy. This is just adding the Wigner-Wille distribution of each atom to create that plot. And so we get this signal described in a very concise way down here using 5 terms. Now, if we add a bunch of noise to the signal, what comes out? Almost the same atoms. If I cycle back and forth, one of the aspects of this algorithm is that it's very robust to noise. Even when you perturb the input signal by a lot of noise, as long as there's some similarity with the dictionary atoms themselves, you can return back to the same decomposition. This is not a possibility with the Fourier method, because this is all this stuff is going to be blended into frequencies all over the time frequency plane. So I mentioned adaptive and multi-resolution. Here you can see the plot of the time frequency domain with respect to the time signal, time domain signal. You see the attacks occurring here. If we zoom in, you can see those attacks more clearly as short atoms, and the long atoms take care of the sinusoids. So we can take this representation and say, find me the short atoms. This is the representation of the short atoms. Find me the long atoms. And what do we get back? We get back the tonal portions of the signal and the attack portions. Very simple. The algorithm, of course, takes a couple dozen minutes, maybe half an hour to compute over this long dictionary. But we have a very simple way to partition the representation into a functional, meaningful representation. Now, you can't really do this without a lot of post-processing from the short-time Fourier transform. So we've gained some benefits here. But here's a feature. I won't call it a drawback, but it's a feature. We've created this UCSB signal, much the way the IBM labs moved the atoms around to spell it. I just moved them in the time frequency domain. And here's the time domain signal that comes out of this. Now, what happens if we decompose this time domain signal using a dictionary of Gabor atoms that have the exact same atoms that we use to compose this signal? We get this. The algorithm has performed exactly what it should. It has selected the atoms that are very highly correlated with the signal. So these three atoms here, short scale, take out a lot of the energy here. They're seen as similar to the signal by the energy. It doesn't even consider this spike was created by a constructive interference of these 5 atoms placed on top of each other in phase. It just grabs as much as it can at each step, and that's why it's called a greedy algorithm. But it has shown us another representation of the signal in another space that could provide some benefits. Maybe this particular way of encoding the signal is more efficient. It has more energy and a fewer number of terms than this one. Or perhaps it's more robust to noise. So this possibility of being able to represent a signal in many different ways has a musical application, because some could be more amenable to pitch shifting or time scaling or some motivations like that. So I guess that's my part of the presentation. Thank you for listening, and I hand it over to Joanne. Question? Right. No, there's many practical applications, and it's one of the most recent and hot topics now is called compressive sensing, where instead of oversampling a signal at a high rate and then throwing away data when you compress it, you perform the two steps at the same time. And so you have this dictionary that you project the signal onto, you keep those elements, and you're able to sample the signal at a much lower rate than Nyquist theory tells you. And you're able to reconstruct the signal. So this has been used practically for functional magnetic resonance imaging, where you have a huge throughput of data, but they take this massive amount of data and they compress it so that it'll fit on their computers. Well, you don't need to do that. And they show that using these methods, these dictionary-based methods, that you're able to really cut down on the amount of data that you send and be able to reconstruct the signal perfectly. Visual data, audio data, any sort of data. As long as it's sparse in some domain, it'll benefit from these techniques. Musical signals are sparse not only in a wavelet domain when you have a lot of attacks, but they're also sparse in a Fourier domain because you have a lot of sustained things. But you can't use Fourier analysis. You can't use orthonormal transformations on these things because you have to pay a price of the two. So you combine the dictionaries together and you're able to get a representation that is much higher level than you would with just a single orthonormal transformation. So source separation is another one, where you can take a complex auditory scene and be able to separate the contents of that based on what's in your dictionaries. So Homeland Security is very interested in that sort of application. And I'm steering more the safe direction towards musical applications of them, not so much spying. So, but those are just a few of the applications. That's another interesting aspect. Gabor was onto something when he proposed these small quanta, acoustic quanta of information, and decomposing sound in that way. Many of the experiments that have been run on learning dictionaries from environmental sounds, like lion roars or human speech, find that the atoms that are learned bear a high similarity to the auditory cortex signals that are sent and passed between the ear and the brain. And that's a very interesting biological confirmation of the theory, in a sense. Right. Yes. Yeah, one more question. And That's the science of constructing a dictionary. And you can do it very inefficiently by including in your dictionary every single translation of the atom that you have. But you can do it very efficiently if you perform those correlations in the frequency domain and just point-wise multiply inverse. So there is a good science to it. So, well, without further ado, I'll introduce Joanne. Thank you very much.
Somebody want to help me hook everything up? For those of us that are... Oh, this is always difficult. Okay, can I be heard for the sake of the people out there in the world? Now, this was great that both Bob and Curtis spoke before I spoke, because I'm really going to begin by giving you an overview of what we do as media artists. Why are we doing this? I mean, you know, what is this all about? I think it's really important that we answer these questions. And I'll wait until Lance is out of the way. And really, in order to define who we are as media artists, what it is that we do, I mean, media artists, we're visual artists, we're composers, and what we do is really unfold, take mathematical algorithms and unfold this information over time and space. And we're interested in looking for the same things that a lot of our scientist colleagues are interested in looking at. What's structural? What's functional? How do we best represent n-dimensional data sets? Why are we interested in that? For purely aesthetic purposes. We're artists. We want to map time and space. That's what we do best. The interesting thing is, the more that we look for more rich and fertile data, the closer we become to our science colleagues who have such incredible information for us to share. I think that we're closest to our colleagues right here at KITP, because the more abstract the data is, the more that we can map this data without any real connections to real data, this is where our hearts lie. But we can now take this from the theoretical, and we can push this into really the community that we're in the Nanosystems Institute. Well, why is a digital media center in a California Nanosystems Institute? Well, it's a very interesting question. I think you've seen what we do as media artists, and if you look at the matte little ball up there and the lines that it points to, really these four areas are what we cover. We're music visual artists, but also computer science and electrical engineering. So we're really media artists and engineers building some of the most complex systems in order to parse n-dimensional data sets. Now, if you take that in conjunction with our partners in the California Nanosystems Institute and in the Institute for Theoretical Physics, these are our science colleagues that we're working with to map n-dimensional data sets in time and space. So media artists really know how to map this data. The scientist has a particular data set that they want to have mapped. The engineers are building one of the largest computational systems in the world. That's what the Allosphere is. That's the community that we're building in the CNSI. And so a little bit about what this Allosphere is, this large scientific and artistic instrument that I hope all of you will come and see, so that you could see the research we're doing in there, because I'm going to push over to the general talk and I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues Lance Putnam and Dennis Atherton to talk about the specific research that we have been doing with Luca Politi and the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. We're going to show it to you here in 2D, and would love for you to come and be immersed in the time-dependent hydrogen atom Schrodinger equation in 3D in the Allosphere at the end of the talk. But this slide, I'm sure I've given you all an opportunity to read through what it is that we do over there, so I'm not going to reiterate it. But let me play you just a little video that kind of will give you a sense of what it's like going in. We've got the audio plugged in as well? Okay. Oops, what did I do? Oh, that's right. I've got to get into my little thing, and I've got to click, and then I've got to... Did I pause it again? There. I think it will. Yeah. So this is the sphere that you're going into. So this is the virtual model of the Allosphere. And this is actually real fMRI brain data. So this is a 3D model of my colleague's brain. This is two layers of blood tissue, and we have intelligent agents that are flying through this space, mining blood density levels for you, and reporting that information to you sonically. At this point, it's just an alliterative mapping of the data. Higher pitches, higher densities, lower pitches, lower densities. My colleague actually sitting in the audience, Marcus Novak, you're flying through his brain right now. This was the beginning of our research, and it's very interesting because what we're doing is we're going from the macroscopic level down to the microscopic level. Why are we doing this? Again, because we're composers, we're artists. Every single line you draw, every single sound you hear has a mathematical construct connected to it. I want to be able to control. For 24 years, I've been building oral mathematical systems that unfold in time and space. I've got frequency and time down. Space is very important to me. Something like the Schrodinger equation will allow me to convolve information and totally connect time, frequency, and space together. For the first time, I'll have a reason that I'm spatially locating my information. There's nothing more gratifying to a composer than being able to get down to that level and that kind of control of your material. And interestingly enough, one of the things that we do, we're holistic beasts, okay? We want to see the whole system. We'll put it together sometimes down and dirty so we can see what the results will be. Now, we believe that that's really going to be important for our science partners because we do believe as artists that it's important for you to perceive your data, to be able to distance yourself from your data, to be able to get a view of your data as a third-party viewer. That is a lot of what we're doing in the allosphere. We consider the allosphere one of the largest scientific and artistic instruments in the world that we're building. The space itself, I mean, this has been scientifically prepared. It's 24 years of my research in media systems and design. It's a three-story near to anechoic cube that's holding a metal sphere. There are no standing waves in that space. That means that space is completely neutral audio-wise once we get the projectors completely down to a 20 dB noise floor. We're working on that. But that means if that space has no standing waves in it, then if I have enough sound points, I can design the proper convolution algorithms in order to move the wavefront directly to you. We've figured that out, but that's going to be about 512 to 1024 channels of sound upon completion of the allosphere. We're not there yet. We have 16 channels of sound, but an incredible spatialization technique called third-order ambisonics, spherical harmonics, which we do sound-wise. The connections are absolutely incredible between what we're finding in the math and the physics and what we're seeing as arts. So again, a 360-degree, three-story sphere, once it's fully equipped, you'll have complete immersion. Right now we have a slice of it, and again, complete audio immersion, and everything gestural interactive. We're not simulating virtual reality. We're going to try to simulate reality in this space. That's why $10 million worth of prepared space to simulate reality. That means total deprivation of noise, total deprivation of sight signal. We're projecting on super black screens. We're the only place in the world to do this. This space is prepared precisely what it was supposed to be prepared for, to do hard-scale scientific and artistic research. So we're really excited about the space. Again, we're in the corner of the CNSI, but we've got staging laboratories that build up to the allosphere. It's going to take all of us to really use this instrument and build this instrument. This instrument will never be complete, but it will always be used. I want functional materials in there. I want paint. I don't want to use projectors. I want to really move the whole idea of IT materials in order to build new systems to do the things that I want to do. So let's talk about what some of those things are. And I want to get down to some specific research that we're doing in the allosphere. Here's four demos that we're going to give you today. And it's going to show you the method in us artist madness and why we're seeking you out so aggressively because we need you so much. What are we worried about here? As artists, we're worried about structure and function. When I build a piece of music, I'm unfolding an oral system that moves over time and space. The interesting thing is I say to some of my bioengineering colleagues, you know, music is about the only thing I can think of that will represent data where the structure grows over time with the function, okay? So maybe we should start to think about what data should be sonified and what data should be visualized. Now, this might sound, you know, a little bit weird to you. Why do we want to sonify data? We're multimodal beasts. We use all of our senses. When we're away from the computer and we're in our analog laboratories, working with our special devices, we're using everything. We need to simulate that same kind of construct when we're working with the computer. We need to marry together the analog and the world of computation because we need the brain. We can't deny ourselves anymore that we don't need this brain. I was an instrumentation kid for many years. I wrote for acoustic orchestra. But I had to push myself to marry the analog with this digital domain, and we must get this digital domain to work in such a way that we do in the analog world. The space needs to be prepared, right? We consider this an instrument. It's not a lab. This thing should be scalable. I'm pointing to this thing down to the iPhone. Okay, so this is a real instrument. By the time we get done with this instrument, this means any gesture that we make, if it's connected to a mathematical library, function library, the pool should be right. Okay, we've already done this. We've created hyper violins where you can pull a string out like this, and it's like you're pulling the cat gut 2 feet away from the board, and you're going to get the proper bend microtonally of the pitch. So this is what we want to do. We want to have multi-sensory computing that's done right. So why structural materials? Why functional? Structure and function. That's why I've singled out my SSLEC colleagues, my colleagues in spintronics, that are working with my Microsoft Station Cube colleagues, that are working with my KITP colleagues. Boy, this ties together the whole gamut for us mathematically of structure and function and how we're working together. So I'm going to talk just briefly about our first work with SSLEC in visualizing and sonifying the multicenter hydrogen bond. This is the work of Chris Vandeval's group, computational material scientist in the Solid State Lighting and Energy Laboratory. And there's method in our madness. This is working with a non-time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Then the next step is to go to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation because we want to tie structure and function together. And my colleague Lance Putnam will talk about the 1D Schrodinger visualization and sonification he did, which is classic, and then how he, along with Luca, pushed into the 3D time-dependent Schrodinger with a visualization and solidification of hydrogen, and we've got four examples of that. And then we'll end with my research engineering colleague, Dennis Atherton, who is going to take that now down to spin, and we're doing beginning attempts with a block sphere, and he has some interactive devices to show this information to you. So, again, what we did with the multicenter hydrogen bond, and I'll let you read through that stuff if you like to, but I don't like to read through my lectures, so I'll tell you kind of in layman's terms. Our colleagues from SSLEC, they found this new chemical compound. They wanted to know what was going on in this material. When they first came to us, the bond is four zinc atoms that are bonding with one hydrogen atom. And they came to us with these five atoms and said, we want to see this. And we said, well, what do you want to find out from it? We want to see what we made. We're like, well, what would you like to find out? At that point of time, they really weren't sure. I go, are there any more atoms in your lattice? Yes, we have 2,000. I said, can you give us all your data? Can you give us all the dimensions of your data so that we can put it all together for you? And this is exactly what we did. And again, this is static. I'll show you one shot. Here is the multicenter hydrogen bond. Behind that little light, there's one white hydrogen atom that are bonding with those four zinc atoms. Now, when our colleagues came in from SSLEC, they said, what is that in our data? And we said, what do you mean, what is that in our data? It's the data that you gave us. They go, we didn't give you anything that looked like a sea anemone. And I said, well, you gave us these little glyphs, the first order derivatives to the non-time dependent Schrodinger equation. We filled them in. We call them streamlines. And it's showing you the flow of the electrons. And they're like, well, we know, you know, how the bond is occurring. And they're saying, can you do that any place in the lattice? And we're saying, yes, and we have done that. And typically, the lines are going perpendicular to the isosurfaces. But there are places in the lattice where they all go horizontal and they circle these zero levels. And we thought it was a bug in our program. And they said, oh my God, you found this term that they call zero flux, which are the nodes, the points, the potential points of bonding in that lattice. And so we're about ready to come out with a publication with them and really push 3D visualization to another level. Just a little bit, I'll give you a quick demo of the hydrogen to try to titillate you to come over to the... This is the new Bond film, yes. This is the search for the hydrogen bond. Now let me tell you a little bit about the sonification. That's why I want you to come over to the Allosphere to really hear it and to be immersed in it. 2D, what we did was, you know, they gave us time, space, and intensity coordinates of where the atoms were. We mapped everything in time, in space. And then we said, well, why do you want your atoms to look like little balls and to be red and blue? And that's typically how we view them. And we said, what about the emission spectrums? And they go, well, we don't want to see that. And I said, do you mind if we drop them 27 octaves and sonify it? These are known constants, so oxygen will always sound a certain way, hydrogen will always sound a certain way, and zinc will always sound a certain way. And they said, well, yeah, but we don't know what good that's going to do us. Well, it's interesting because they've really moved from, not caring about sonification to asking us to localize sonification. Do you have to have all the atoms on at once? Can you point and hear the bonds? And so these are all the things that we're currently working on now. And actually, my researcher, Bashak Alper, who's in the audience, will in detail talk about the bond when we coerce you all to come over to the allosphere in a little while. So, moving right along, I am going to turn the talk over, now that we're leaving space and going to space and time, to Lance Putnam, who will talk about the work with the Schrodinger. The time
One of the things, Joanne, I'm Lance Putnam. I'm a PhD candidate in the Media Arts and Technology program. Introduce myself. So one of the things Joanne was talking about was kind of what the media artist's role could be in looking at working with scientists. And I think one of the main things that I've been finding out is that we can help represent this information in a way that might not be possible in another modality. So I know mathematics are used, very widely in the sciences, but there's definitely other approaches to understanding process. And most of what scientists are looking at is nature, which is evolving over time. It's some process evolving over time. So it's not always necessary to represent it in a completely symbolic fashion. There might be another way where you can transduce it into another physical representation. So one of the things that interests me about the Schrodinger equation is that it does represent like a small kernel of space-time in some fashion. So one of the first experiments I did was to simulate a classical 1D Schrodinger equation with a simple rectangular potential. So this is very interesting because it also forms a bridge with computer music, which I kind of have a roots in that field. So one of the things that's interesting about it is that it adds a dimension of space. Usually in sound synthesis, time is kind of the primary component. But with the Schrodinger equation, you add elements of space. So you have to work with spatial components of the sound as well. So the main thing with the Schrodinger is that it adds an environment that your sound can evolve in. So it does kind of solve some interesting problems with artistic problems of complexity and creating processes that will help your form evolve over time. And the nice thing is, it's all mathematically, has a mathematical foundation. So it's, at some point you can predict what it's gonna do and control it. So I have a short video of a study I did where I made a program where I could inject grains into the, as the wave function, so I can add them onto the current wave function. And then I can control in real time. This gray rectangle right here is the potential, so it's like a voltage. But I can control the width and height of that, and you'll see how it influences the wave function as it evolves over time. So this is a visual and sonic representation of the Schrodinger equation. Oh, so the two waveforms, the white is the probability function, and the white line on the top is the probability function, so that's the magnitude of the wave function. And then the green and magenta are the real and imaginary components, so you can get a sense of the phase of the wave function. Sorry? Oh, like a phaser. I haven't tried that. Yeah, for this, I wanted to get a sense of the global evolution of it. So it's in on a flat plane. Yeah. Phaser. So you can see there's certain, I mean, this is physical, I mean, waves do this. So there's, you get interesting processes of refraction and reflection. Oh, yeah, I didn't do that. So the way I'm sonifying it is, I'm actually, so this is a purely spatial representation here, going across the x-axis. So what I did to sonify it is I put a scanner that scans through space. And that's running at audio rate. So I can actually control the rate at which it scans through the space to control the fundamental frequency. So as it's scanning through, it just converts those samples into sound samples. Yes. Well, I can choose the initial conditions, the wave function. So like a Gaussian with a sine curve under it. Oh, so I kind of broke the rules a little bit and added.
Hey, don't.
I wanted it to dissipate a little bit. Oh, that's because I'm scanning through the space at a certain rate over time. So that's going to pick the fundamental frequency. Yeah, right. But you could think of it as your scan rate is kind of the pitch of your note. That you're playing. Yeah, there's periodic. Yeah. So it's kind of a toroidal phase. So what we're working on now with Luca is to take it to the next level in all regards. So we've been looking at running this 3D Schrodinger equation, time dependent. And now this poses some interesting challenges in order to get a sense of what's going on as the wave function evolves. If you do like very naive, take a naive approach to it, of just rendering a volume, it's in some ways that technique doesn't give you a sense of some of the features that might be interesting in the wave function. Luca has helped point out some of these features that might be interesting to visualize in a very direct way. So the two things are the probability flux and the probability gradient. So these are features based on the wave function and how it changes through space. One of a common visualization technique is to use streamlines going through a vector field. And what we did is the streamlines aren't static like they are in the hydrogen bond as we showed, but they actually evolve over time. So each one of these streamlines has a lifetime. It starts at a certain point, it follows along the vector field, and then it dies and goes away. It'll regenerate itself in another location. So this, I'll show you examples of this, but it's kind of like
if you know what you're looking for in the data, it can directly show you that, that cicada data. So this is kind of a creative approach to getting a sense of the volumetric data. So we're using that technique to visualize the wave function. And the sonification of the space has posed a serious challenge, both technically and conceptually. It's difficult to sonify a volume evolving over time because basically you can't run it at an audio rate. So if you wanted to listen at each point in space and just hear the waveform it produces over time, it's very difficult to do that right now because we can't run it fast enough. So one of the ideas we had is to listen to the spatial characteristics of the wave function. So one of the a common technique is to use a wave scanning. So each one of these rings, these are concentric rings around a center point in the space, and this can be oriented any way you want. I'm just showing it in 2D so you can get a sense of what I'm talking about. But these rings are run at a specific rate. So the way we've done it is the center ring runs at a lower frequency, and as you go out, they run at higher frequencies. So if when it runs over the wave function, it's going to convert that directly into a sound sample. So if there's more distribution in the middle, you're going to get a lower timbre. And as it spreads out, you'll hear a higher timbre. So you can hear the changes in the timbre. And it's interesting because each wave function has its own timbral identity. And I'll play an example of that. So I should, before I play it more, I should point out that this is the superposition of three of the orbitals of a hydrogen atom. In this case, you can see the N, L, and M values on the left. So basically, the 100 is the lowest orbital, and then there's a superposition of two higher ones on top of that, and they're all being summed together in space. So what this is showing here is just a standard volume rendering of the wave function.
That's the probability
wave. Yes. And so the phases are mapped into hue. So there's the real and imaginary components are mapped to different colors. There's a green and a blue. So here's these are the dynamic streamers. So these are the agents that are, they're following along the probability current. So you can see how they're tracing out. You can see more about another feature in the data you can't see just in the volume data. That'll come up in a minute. So now these are this is showing you the probability gradient. So this is using the same exact technique, but just using they're going along a different vector field. And they're also colored, different colors, so that you can actually visualize two different features at the same time, and they'll have their own identities. So you can separate them out, see how they correlate. I'll show more examples. This is another orbital I've added. So we have the three separate energy levels now. So you can also hear how the timbre has changed. There's formant in the mid-range. So now this is kind of going inside of the atom, you could look at specific features inside by going into it. And this is a this configuration is actually one that will emit light. So each one of the N, L, and M differ by one value. This is the probability flux again. This is going inside of it. You can see that the gradients trace out a ring in the middle, which is very hard to see in the volume rendering. I'd like to turn it over to Dennis Adderson to talk about his work with the block sphere.
Okay, well, we're running late, so I'll make do with the settings I'm given and talk for a brief minute about what I'm doing. One of the goals for the Allosphere is the quantum symphony. So we want to know how to work with electron spin, what it's going to sound like. To approach this, we went to the laboratory and we went to an experiment where spin precession was being measured optically, and we presumed that we could listen to it by transposing optical modulations to audible modulations. This is a pump probe measurement of electron spin. Let's see what I'm going on. Yeah, so the implementation is, in audio, so it's on the audio DSP, and we derive visualizations from it, and the model comes from the block sphere, which gives us, is nice because it gives us a three-dimensional representation, which is appropriate for our goals in the Allosphere. This was the experiment, Jesse Berezovsky, ultra-fast coherent optical manipulation of a single electron spin in a quantum dot. We mapped the features of this experiment that we could extract from the data. There's a block sphere picture of what he's doing. He's exciting an electron with a static magnetic field that is giving precession around the magnetic field that is at a frequency proportional to the magnetic field. And as it turns out, when we map to the audio domain, if we divide by wavelength, basically to convert from the frequency of light to the frequency of sound, the Larmor frequency falls right in the audible range. And so how this experiment is performed is with laser pulses. There's a tipping laser pulse that rotates the spin of the electron mid-precession, 180 degrees in phase through an orthogonal direction. We call that axis, or that angle, phi. And so that's what I'm going to be able to modulate. This was the diagram of the experiment, which is all built with laser pulses. There's an excitation laser pulse and a measurement laser pulse. And this is the model from the experiment, basically precession around the Bloch sphere with a tipping angle, phi, that happens at a time, t tip. It's given in two separate equations. To make an audio model out of this, what we do is we turn these terms, the tipping time and the tipping angle, into signals. And at the tipping time, you know, we just turn those signals on. So here's what the mapping looked like. We get the Larmor frequency, and this is at the parameters the experiment's using, 1.6 kilohertz. The laser pulse, which was 76 megahertz down to 87 hertz, and the probe time constant, which we just use a low-pass filter, turns out to be around 700 hertz. So it sounds a bit muted. So I'm going to go to the demo, but I'll give the summing up in advance so that I can just switch over. So to address the details of where we might have diverged, so modulation of the tipping angle. You can't really do this with the laser that they're given in the experiment. You can change the tipping angle by changing the laser intensity, but we're going to presume that we can modulate that sinusoidally. Variability of the laser pulse frequency, it's fixed at 76 megahertz in the experiment, but that's not limited by the quantum dots, so we're going to presume that we can change that. And how decoherence isn't represented in the Bloch sphere model that we're addressing, but we have a parameter from the experiment that's just a time constant of an exponential decay, which we use for the audio amplitude and the graph brightness. And so this work is a midpoint for the goals to develop an audio model for entanglement and to incorporate an accurate model of decoherence and to learn to compose music with qubits. So let me pull the demo up. So the first thing I'm showing is basically the experiment. So this is the sphere I've just rotated according to a cube, just to give you the different angles. And let me see if I have sound. So it's not doing anything but rotating 180 degrees with the tipping pulse. And this is what they performed in the experiment to see that they could manipulate the electron within the decoherence time. Turn off my hold on the plot. Oops. So the time scale that we mapped to the audio was practically to divide by a million. To show it graphically, I'm dividing by another 1,000. So I'm going to turn that frequency up. So now I'm at the audio frequency. And you can see this is the tipping angle. Now, to make it interesting, I presume that I can modulate that. And then you can see the sphere. This is so we're working on an interface too. This interface also lets you tilt to look around. this is just like fun with oscilloscopes in the lab, but with a qubit. You can see the delay angle of the tipping pulse. You have to operate the tipping pulse at the pi by 2 delay to be able to move the spin in that axis. So I could probably do this all day, but I don't want to bore you. Thank you.